It means those who are older among us, who've lived a while, learned a lot about life, learned a lot from the Word of God about life and themselves and other people. Generally, these are the people in any endeavor, leaders in any endeavor, mostly are those that have been around a while and have some experience. And then we talked about temperament, what kind of personality traits, what kind of thinking they're accustomed to doing in their lives, sober-minded, for example, and self-control, people whose lives are not out of control, and their thinking is not frivolous and scattered, but able to focus on matters of importance. Today we're going to look at the categories of moral purity, influence, and then to conclude the lesson, that doesn't say much about elders, does it? All right, Danny, help me back there. If I can get some elders up, that would be good. We're going to look at their wives and the role that they might play in the leadership of shepherds of the people of God. So you might want to put a finger in Titus 1, put one in 1 Timothy 3. We'll be back and forth between those as we're looking at these passages. All right. Go. One more. Hey, that looks better. All right. Qualifications of shepherds, and specifically evidence of moral purity. Titus chapter 1 and verse 8. We have two descriptions we'll look at the same time here. Lover of what is good and holy. First thing I would like to notice with you about this particular qualification is this is not someone who's just casually or occasionally interested in doing good, but you'll notice the word lover here. This is a person who is desirous of and devoted to a holy outcome in all situations. He is anxious for good to be done. He's diligent about good being done and will support that good with church resources, with his own personal energies, will encourage it in the lives of other people. The opposite of this would be someone who might be stingy with goodness. You might wonder how in the world that could possibly be. Why would anybody want to be stingy with goodness? But think about it. Think about people that you've known. It's not uncommon for elders to hoard goodness, hoard the physical resources of the congregation, be so conservative about things that they're not expending all that's available to see that good is done. And that could be monetarily, but it's not only monetarily. These are people that will be devoted diligently to accomplishing as much good as can be done based on the resources God has given. They're not reluctant to involve themselves in doing good. They're not trying to find ways around opportunities to help or be a benefit to others. I'd also notice about this that there's no ulterior motive in those that we would be considering to serve as shepherds. No lurking harshness. No impropriety. No masked morality. But goodness is what these men are. There are some people you may at times wonder how deep the goodness goes. But when we begin looking for spiritual shepherds, those that will lead us by example so much in their lives, those that will influence by the lives that they're living, we're going to be looking more deeply than superficial. A lover of what is good and someone who is holy, truly set apart unto God and devoted to Him for service and in the relationship that they sustain with Him. Oops, there went my topic. Maybe doing that through the slides. Evidence of moral purity, not given to wine. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, Titus chapter 1 and verse 7. We could go into a lot of technical details about the wording here, but I think simply I would describe it as being influenced by the effects of alcohol. A man who must be, in his life, the epitome of self-control, sober-mindedness, goodness, and a yielding spirit cannot consistently ingest chemicals that lower his own inhibitions to sinful impulses. That's a mouthful. Let me do that again. A man who must be the epitome of self-control, sober-mindedness, goodness, and a yielding spirit cannot consistently ingest chemicals that lower inhibitions to sinful impulses, and that's what alcohol does. It lowers our inhibitions. And so it is patently inconsistent for a man to be the glowing example in the congregation of control of himself, to yield to chemicals that lower that control. And then if he insists that he can ingest alcohol but not lose that control, my second question in that regard would be, if he cannot or will not abandon his personal preference in order to remove any doubts that others may have, and there will be doubts on this particular issue, how is he qualified to lead? If a man is so insistent on having his own way, insisting that he can drink alcohol and it does not affect his self-control and inhibitions, but he's not going to give up that what he sees as a right or a freedom to remove doubt, is that the man who should be leading us? It is naive beyond belief, in my opinion, especially given the intense research of our day into the effects of even small amounts of alcohol, to think that any Christian can drink the concentrations in modern drinks and not be affected. And this can be demonstrated, illustrated in all kinds of ways. There are very, very strict standards that are applied to airline pilots, and aren't you glad? Aren't you glad that there's a very, very low tolerance in flying airplanes when other people are entrusted to you? There's a low tolerance for having alcohol in the bloodstream. In NASCAR racing, there is zero tolerance. Other lives are in your hands. Well, lives are in the hands of elders. And I think on a level much more important than a plane crashing or a race car wrecking, under the hand of elders are the souls of people. Remember Hebrews 13? They watch for your souls. You can be killed in an airplane crash and not lose your soul. But if elders aren't providing the kind of leadership they should, especially ones that may be impaired by their affection for alcohol, our souls could be jeopardized. Sometimes the sons of this world, brethren, are wiser than the sons of light. And this is a growing concern among the people of God. Should be something that we're growing in awareness of. Those that insist on being able to socially buy, drink in front of others, enjoy the effects of alcohol, and pretend like it doesn't affect them spiritually. I would encourage all of us to think more deeply on that particular level. But I dare say we would have no respect for a man who had to have a drink of alcohol before going into an elder's meeting to settle his nerves. Let's be serious about this, folks. We're not going to admire that. We're not going to put that on a pedestal. I don't care what our argument is about social drinking and being away on a business trip or whatever. You would not respect an elder who had to have a drink to calm his nerves. So whatever we want to make out of not given to wine, we better end up at the place that says he's not affected by alcohol, and it doesn't take much to do it. Then we have not greedy for money. Well, going to drop in moral purity there again. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, not greedy for money. Greed may cause an elder to neglect his spiritual duties in pursuit of acquisition, or to track his investments and make sure that what he has invested is prospering. He may be so concentrated in his life on a promotion that spiritual things are neglected. Perhaps even more ominously, he may be negatively influenced in the responsible disbursement of the congregational funds. And let's not minimize that. I'm not going to go off on a tangent on that, but how the funds of either a congregation or us as individuals is spent is a significant issue. Let's not pretend like, well, it's only money. And that's how some have dismissed the concerns over institutionalism and the social gospel. Well, it's just money. We put our money where our beliefs are. And we need to be very careful in our personal lives, but especially in the congregational expenditure of funds, that we're acting consistently with doctrine. And so an elder is going to have opportunity. He's going to have access to money. He's going to have opportunity to spend it. according to certain principles and beliefs. And a man who is greedy will not do so as he should. And so we need to look at the lives of those men who would be shepherds. Is there unnecessary overtime being worked for the accumulation of things? Is he a man who's living beyond his means and thus demonstrating not only perhaps greed, but no self-control? Is he a man who's content or not with his possessions? Might he be involved in shady business practices in order to keep the business growing, keep ahead of the competition? All of this comes out of a desire to acquire. And those who would be shepherds are those that should be amongst us focused on spiritual things and understand eternal issues and point us as a congregation in that direction and not himself be distracted with things of the world. Well, let's move along to evidence of good influence. The ultimate challenge of being an elder is to communicate with and influence people. And not just influence them in any way, but influence them to be closer to God. And so we've said several times already in this series, being an elder is the ultimate people job. It demands strong interpersonal relationships, influence, an example, impressions that are left, the character of a man before others. And so as we consider matters of good influence, these are going to, by and large, involve an elder's life relative to his interaction with other people. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2 and Titus chapter 1 verses 6 and 7 present to us the qualification of being blameless. Let's first of all say something about what that doesn't mean, so far as I understand the word. It does not mean merely above accusation. For even Jesus was accused falsely and maligned, and he was the source of much contention, and so was Paul. But in regard to being blameless, I believe the impetus here is focused on making substantive charges against a man. That is, an elder or prospective elder is not due reprimand or correction because he deserves it. That very openly fault can be seen and pointed out in his life, and upon further examination, the charges stick. He is guilty of this, or he is guilty of that, or he is weak here, or weak there. Blameless carries with it the idea of not being justifiably accused. I'd also like to point out that blameless does not mean never has done anything wrong. And this might be a challenge for us in searching through the lives of men here, prospective elders, that especially if we've known a while. It might be that we're aware of some faults from former times, and it might be very difficult to get past those. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 1, Peter refers to himself as a fellow elder. And I probably don't need to point out to this audience, the one writing that had denied the Lord and shunned the Gentiles, even after preaching, that they would be and must be granted entrance into the kingdom on the same basis as Jews, having gone to the household of Cornelius and baptized him. And so we're not talking about here perfection forever and ever. And perhaps in preaching through these things, there is a danger that it seems we're setting the bar so high, raising the standard so high, we might wonder if anybody would ever be qualified. Well, if I'm preaching the truth on this, I'm not going to apologize for setting the bar high. If I'm preaching the truth, I'm preaching what the Holy Spirit sets forth as being the criteria. If we don't meet that, that's our fault. That's not the Scripture's fault. It's not the preacher's fault. What we need to be doing is aspiring to the qualifications. We need to be understanding them. They need to be an objective in our lives from early years. And we need to be working toward these things as a goal, whether we're searching actively as we're doing now or not. But I do suppose we can lay it on a little thick, maybe, and leave the impression that no one could ever be qualified for this particular position. This must be a man, in being blameless, who does not have a bunch of holes in his life that we can, you know, shove a finger through and say, well, he's missing this and he's not done this right, and there's obvious other flaws and faults, he's not blameless. We've all made mistakes in the past. Have they been corrected? Is there signs of repentance? Is there evidence that the man has grown beyond mistakes that have been made in the past? If so, take that into account, realizing that no one is perfect. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 7, a good testimony among unbelievers, that is, the community at large, must recognize his integrity and acknowledge his solid character. Listen, even if they disagree with his doctrinal conclusions on things, they may disagree with the moral standard actually that he upholds, but they see consistency in him. They see a man who's consistent, though they may disagree with what he advances in his life, but they see a man consistent with that. An obvious Old Testament example of that would be Daniel. In fact, turn to Daniel chapter 6. Let's just briefly read the observation made here about Daniel by his enemies. Daniel 6, verses 4 and 5. Well, look at verse 3 to get the reason why they feel toward Daniel as they do. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Listen, folks, if we're doing well in our lives by God, we're living the right kind of life, and perhaps God blesses us to advance among men, we will make enemies on that basis alone. There'll be people that will not like it because, oh, Mr. Goody Two Shoes over here is getting a promotion or gets more money than I get or whatever. In this case, it's much more serious than that. Daniel's being promoted over the kingdom. So the governors and satraps in verse 4 sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. You don't suppose that's saying he was morally perfect, do you? But under investigation, under examination, looking for a charge that would stick, as we've said about the term blameless, they couldn't find any. No tax returns that were shady. No illegal contributions made. No defrauding the employer, whatever it may be. And looking for a substantive charge, not a yank kind of a thing. And looking for a substantive charge they could hang Daniel on, they couldn't find one. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." There's a great explanation, I think, of blameless. And a good testimony among unbelievers. If they're going to find fault with you, brethren, make sure it's over your faith. Demonstrate consistency. Be the same person in front of unbelievers, co-workers, neighbors, ball team members, social club members. Be the same person in front of them that you are in front of the brethren. Don't let there be two of you, but be consistent. As we've noted already, it's easy to put on an act and select company. Some people can rise to the people that they're with and act above what they truly are. But those kind of people, you put them with those who are below them, morally or spiritually, and they tend to sink to that level. They're merely reflecting their associates. Those that would be leaders among us cannot be like that. They cannot be that unstable. And so we've suggested, I think we talked about it last week, we've suggested perhaps providing opportunities for the congregation to talk to co-workers or neighbors or others outside the body who have known us for a particular period of time, so that we might be examined on this particular issue. Good testimony among unbelievers. How do we know that? How are we going to know that? Unless you work with a brother. And then in Titus chapter 1 and verse 8, we have the term just. This is fair and equitable treatment afforded to all. That is, there's the sense that situations, individual people, whoever they are, will be treated according to consistent principles of what is right. The importance of this is seen in our own nation in a secular way when a judge or a court issues a judgment that is patently unjust. What kind of reaction do you see in people? What then begins to happen to people's view of the judiciary? There's significant questions in our society right now about the validity of jury trials and whether we should do away with them. Because people have, in many cases, lost confidence in the average man to draw moral and judicial conclusions aright. In other words, confidence is lost when justice does not prevail. An elder demonstrates a deep sense of right that goes beyond favoritism, popularity, or personal gain. Others trust his judgment because they're confident that he will arrive at a fair, impartial, and a balanced decision. Justice is fundamental to what elders are to be doing day in and day out because they're dealing with people's lives. They're dealing with judgment. Sometimes they're dealing with matters of opinion and viewpoint. And there must be a tremendous amount of confidence in the sense of justice and fair play of those who serve as elders. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, hospitable. An elder, and in anticipation of the next point, I'll throw in, and his wife. An elder and his wife must be generous, helpful, concerned with the welfare of others. Both his home and his heart are open to those in pain and in need. And let me suggest this. This goes beyond merely a personality trait. Not everyone is extroverted or comfortable with other people. I believe hospitality here involves the will more than it does the personality. An elder cannot be aloof, distant, unconcerned about the brethren. Again, we're talking about the ultimate people job. You're talking about what truly bothers or troubles people at the deepest level of their lives. You're talking about grief and sorrow and fears and loss and disappointment and failure. Their own mistreatment at the hands of other people. Marriages that are coming apart. Raising children. I mean, the issues that elders are going to be dealing with in the lives of other people are the most difficult, trying, extreme issues that are going to be dealt with. If they weren't, well, people could fix them themselves. But it's like Moses, you know, bring me the hard cases. Y'all deal with these, bring me the hard cases. Well, the elders get the hard cases. And there must be this sense of hospitality, not merely in opening the home, though I think that's included, it's opening the heart. It's welcoming people to come close to you. Approachability. They see that you really do care about them. And so it's not so much a personality trait, I think, as a trait of the will. It is a conscious decision to be open to other people and interested in them and provide time for them. And even in physical demeanor, demonstrating that I am approachable. With that said, now let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 11, the last major point we're going to make. And in fact, the end of our consideration of the characteristics that are given, the qualifications of elders. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 11, in the middle of discussing, having discussed elders and then discussing deacons, you have this verse sort of thrown in here seemingly in the middle of things. Likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful, and all things. There's some textual ambiguity. It's a big fancy way of saying it's hard to figure out what this means. There's a textual ambiguity here that makes it difficult to determine what women are under consideration. Is it the wives of the deacons? Is it the wives of the elders? Is it the wives of elders and deacons? And I'm opting for number three. And that's the way I've approached this before. It's the way I would approach it now. I believe what he's talking about here, though again there's some ambiguity, is those who serve as deacons and elders must have wives of these qualities. And so that's the way we'll deal with them here just very briefly. But before we do, let me just make an observation or two. Marriage is an integral part of a man's spiritual development and an integral part of his influence. Scriptures tell us inspirational stories in various places of godly women who served God in their own right and encouraged their husbands to accomplish things that were beyond their own abilities. the role that a wife will play in the life of any man is going to be vital and important, but especially so in the life of an elder or a deacon. On the other hand, a man might be disqualified to serve because of his wife. She may not be willing to serve in that capacity. She may not be as committed to the Lord as he is. It may be that she doesn't want her life interfered with by church issues. The life of an elder is going to take him away from his wife. And sometimes over difficult issues that trouble him, sometimes over a period of time. And it may be she doesn't want to share that. She may not want to live in a fishbowl where every move you make is going to be evaluated, potentially criticized. From what you wear to how you do your hair to how you keep your home, etc., etc. It's going to happen. Just the way things are, and it's a sad commentary on humanity and how frivolous we can be, but it's the way things are. It may be that she doesn't want to see her husband attacked and slandered. It could be very, very painful. I think all of us would admit we'd rather things like that happen to ourselves than our mate or see it happen to our children. It's very difficult to watch your husband go through criticism, and yet it's going to happen again for those who are the wives of elders. Godly wives will hopefully consider the potential negatives and hardships, see them as of lesser significance than the potential benefits and rewards. But nonetheless, each woman is going to have to make this decision in regard to serving in this capacity along with their husbands. Very briefly, whoops, already had reverent there. Likewise, their wives must be reverent. That is, their wives must be sober, serious, mature. They cannot be trifling, petty, bogged down with frivolous and trivial distractions. Again, these wives are going to be dealing with serious issues alongside of their husbands as support, not as an associate elder. And we could pull over and park here and talk about elders that have gone into meetings and agreed to a decision and gone home and had their wives change the decision and call the other men and inform them that their mind has been changed. They never admit it. Their wife did it. But that's not uncommon. She's not an associate elder. She certainly does have the ear of her husband and is a great influence, but in that sense, this is not a team undertaking. And so she must understand what her place is in her husband's life as an elder. A woman who's not spiritually oriented can do great harm to the influence of her husband. Then not slanderers, with access to privileged information and more things about the congregation than she would ever want to know. The tendency to talk out of turn, to be involved in malicious gossip and unguarded speech can do great damage. And I think it's because of that access to information this particular qualification is here. Not slanders, not spreading stories that ought to remain private. Temperate. This is the same as the qualification for an elder in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2. A balanced, deliberate, sober, controlled demeanor. This is not a woman who lives by her impulses, is undisciplined and given to extremes. She lives a well-ordered life. She has her life in control. Listen, folks, things happen to all of us that are a challenge to us to deal with and keep a handle on. But we're here talking about a woman who this is not characteristic of her life, that it's just totally undisciplined and always spinning out of control. We'll add the last one here, faithful in all things. She must be trustworthy, reliable, true to the principles of godliness as she goes about her daily life. So what questions can you ask in this regard? Does she keep her word and her appointments? Is she dependable? Or do you always wonder if she's going to come through as she promised? Is she spiritually stable? Or is there evidence of doubt and uncertainty in her mind and in her life? That's probably a little too quick to deal with that, but we're running out of time in the lesson this morning. But a lot to think about and a lot to ponder on relative to men and their wives, and based on some other qualifications we've talked about, their children. This is not a superficial or quick process to try to work through. There are serious questions that need to be asked, serious matters that need to be discussed. We've said before, it can be very touchy and uncomfortable. We must engage in it with decorum and sensitivity. But the hard questions have to be asked. If there are concerns that we have and we're not concerned enough to ask them, not diligent enough about this process, then we might find at the end of the day we've made a big mistake. It's not comfortable, but God's put us in this position and wants us to be responsible as we assist Him in recognizing and submitting the leadership appointed over His people. A summary statement: the brother under consideration will be morally pure and consistent, a genuinely good man who is known by friend and foe alike for his principles of fairness and justice. He is free from carnal influences, for example, from alcohol and materialism, and his life is unblemished by substantive charges of wrongdoing. He and his wife open their home and hearts to the sheep. His wife is a strong, supportive partner whose spirituality reflects her own faith in the light of his leadership. She is an asset and a credit to his work for the Lord and a valuable servant in her own right. Again, no one would deny these are high standards. But I tell you, there's a sense in which they not only apply to elders and their wives, prospective elders. Is there not a sense in all of this in which we all should be aspiring to these qualities? Is God only saying to us here, well, you know, the elite among my people, I want them to have these qualities, and all the riffraff down here, you don't have to worry about that. There is no elite and riffraff among the people of God. The standards of holiness and purity and spirituality apply to all of us. And we're all at different places in this process of growing unto maturity. But as we close, I'll just ask you, where are you in your thinking in regard to aspiring to have these qualities in your own life? These are merely the criteria that God says you must look for and you must evaluate a man and his wife according to these things to be a shepherd of my people. God's not saying they're optional for everybody else. So where are you in this journey of spiritual growth and maturity? Do you have some of these very standards as your goals and objectives? Things that you're working toward in your own life to be well-pleasing unto God. And if by the allowance of circumstance, you might one day be a leader among the people of God. There's work to be done. There's growth to be accomplished by all of us. And there's decisions to be made among the congregation here as to the future of the congregation relative to leadership. I hope and pray the lessons so far have helped us, informed us, motivated us, enlightened us as to what we're facing and how we can most responsibly, with God's help, go through the process. God desires to lead all of us, and we all have characteristics of sheep. May be that someone's here this morning who's not quite sure where they're going in life. Things are fuzzy and life is beginning to crowd out spiritual things. And it might be that there's someone here who wants to obey the gospel and turn their life over to God in entirety, and who understands who Jesus is and what He's done for you. But perhaps to this point in time, you just lack the will to make it happen. If you desire to leave this place with Jesus Christ as your shepherd, faithfully guiding and leading you through this world unto eternal life to be with Him forever, and you're ready to set your will to that end, we want to help you obey the gospel in however way that we can while we stand and sing.